Welcome to Enid Monthly In Depth, the podcast with Enid people for Enid people. Today's guest is Michelle Statham, the program's director for Alzheimer's Association Oklahoma. Michelle talks about growing up in Northwest Oklahoma, her time with the state of Oklahoma, and gives some great information about living with Alzheimer's, both as a patient and as a caregiver. She is especially excited about bringing more resources to the Enid community, including the possibility of an Alzheimer's support group. It was an informative and fascinating conversation, so don't miss it. Hey, this is Robert Falk with Enid Monthly In Depth, and I'm here with a really interesting topic for today. We're going to talk about Alzheimer's, and we've got with us Michelle Statham from the Alzheimer's Association. How are you, Michelle?
I'm good, thank you.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. You're here today because Brookdale Senior Living is having a lecture that's coming up in a couple of weeks, and that's going to be on July 18th, and you're going to come speak a little bit about Alzheimer's, right?
Yes, I am.
Well, great. So. Well, we're really excited to hear about that. But before then, like we talked about, our podcast is a little bit about people. I like to get to know people and like to get to know kind of what they do and why they're here in Enid. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
Well, good. Well, Michelle, I heard you grew up in the neighborhood. Where were you born?
I did. I was actually born in Kansas, lived the first 5 years of my life in Florida. But my family is all from the Oklahoma, Kansas area. So when I was 5 years old, my father moved back to his hometown, Cherokee, Oklahoma, and I spent the rest of my growing up years there. I went to high school, graduated from there, even spent a year in college at Northwestern Oklahoma State University. Well, ride Rangers Ride.
There you go.
Yeah. Right. Moved away to OU and kind of in the city area now, but still my old stomping grounds all the time.
Nice. So right down the road you grew up.
Absolutely.
Well, what did your parents do?
My mother was a teacher, so she actually went back to school in Cherokee. When I was little, and I watched her do that, which is why I was so interested in getting my college degree before I had children and got, you know, busy that way. My dad was a mechanic at a farmer.
Okay. And she was a teacher there in Cherokee?
She was a teacher there in Cherokee for years.
What grade?
Well, she actually taught special ed. So all grades. She did grade school, high school. So she was, her biggest interest was reading. She had a reading specialist, but she loved teaching special ed kids. She had a sister who had that particular disability due to having measles when she was very young. Mm-hmm. So that was very close to her heart.
Nice. Do they still live in Cherokee or are they?
My father does. My mother recently passed. So yeah.
Okay. So who would they, would people, that's a little bit out of our listening area, but if we do have a Cherokee person, who are they?
So Rex and Joanne McDaniel, and my grandparents were John and Faye McDaniel, who were teachers in that area as well. And I mentioned that because when I mentioned it once on a newscast, I had a gentleman actually track me down and call me because my grandmother was his, I think, fourth grade teacher. And he was so inspired by her. He had become a teacher himself and had been a superintendent for years. So that was a wonderful thing to get to hear about, you know, my roots. I knew my grandmother was a teacher, but it was a really nice story about my grandmother who actually had dementia when she passed away. So it was just really nice to have that memory of her.
Well, you've after you graduated college at OU, you said, right?
Yes.
You went to work for the state.
And, I did.
And what'd you do for the state?
Well, I worked for Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services with just a brief couple of years also at Department of Rehab Services. But the majority of my career so far has been spent in substance abuse and mental health, which are brain diseases. So obviously brain health and wellness and brain issues are near and dear to my heart for all kinds of reasons. But yeah, I had a wonderful career there. I did all kinds of things from information systems and building data, because we know that database decisions are important. And I know that's, we even use that in the Alzheimer's Association. Research and data is critical to what we do. So I think it was just kind of a natural progression for me to go into nonprofit after I retired from the state, and spent a little time looking around what I wanted to do. And when this job came open as the director of programs, it fit me to a T, and I have been there for about a year and a half now, and I love it, and I love my team, and I think we really have a lot of work to do in Oklahoma, and we're all very excited to be here to do it.
Well, good. Well, anybody that knows me knows I've got a real heart for substance abuse services and mental health, and I'm a big proponent of increased funding and people really bringing that to understand that it is a brain disease, like you mentioned.
Absolutely. I'm glad to hear you're such a big supporter of it. That makes me feel wonderful.
Well, good. Well, and so that when did you go to work at the Alzheimer's Association?
About a year and a half ago, actually just smack dab in the middle of COVID, which was an interesting change because at that point in time, the association nationwide, nobody worked from offices. We all worked from home, which is hard when you're a community organization. We provide our services in the community. We serve the community. They had just pivoted to all Zoom and online, and every part of what I did, including managing the team that we had there, was all online, which was also a big switch for me. I'm a people person. I get out and I meet and greet, and that's what we do in our community. So it was interesting to start there, but it's been a growing experience. We got a brand new team there. We're all excited to get out, and you know, now with vaccinations and a little bit of care, washing your hands, and you know, being careful about that, you can get out in the community safely and not put vulnerable populations, you know, in at risk. So we are starting to get out there, and I'm just excited to be in Enid.
Well, good. Well, Ed, tell us a little bit about the Alzheimer's Association. Is it a national or a state organization?
Yeah, so they're actually national and even research international, so they really span the globe. I mean, the vision is a world without Alzheimer's and dementia, and they really do worldwide work. But it is a national in that they are based out of Chicago, Illinois, and that's what we call our home office, our partner office. But we have individual chapters that are board-led and executive director-led. So our team is based right here in Oklahoma. We happen to have two major offices in Oklahoma. That's Tulsa and Oklahoma City. But we have team members based all around. There's one right here in Enid. We have them in Lawton. So that's just another reason that I got back into Enid, because Shelby's here. We can talk about her a little more too. But yeah, the organization is actually Oklahoma based. We have an Oklahoma board. We raise money that provides programs right here in Oklahoma.
Well, and you said that you have an Oklahoma board and Oklahoma based. Is it funded nationally, or is it funded by the fundraising that you guys do here in Oklahoma?
A little of both. Yeah, so we do fundraising, and a portion of that stays here, and then a portion of it goes national, because we all support, through our fundraising efforts, research. So research may or may not be in the place that you are a chapter. We do have a little, but that goes back to research. But then, yeah, it's I can't tell you exactly how it's all budgeted, but then there are portions of that that come back to us as well. But a lot of it's just left right here in the Oklahoma chapter.
Okay. Well, all, you know, it's hard to find somebody that doesn't know somebody with Alzheimer's, or at least the beginning of it. First, why don't you define Alzheimer's, and if it's different from dementia or if it's the same? Let's talk about the basics of it first.
Awesome. That's a great question, and I get asked that a lot. So Alzheimer's is a type of dementia. Dementia is an umbrella term that we use to describe many kinds of cognitive problems that are beginning to happen in the brain. They have to do with memory loss and inability to think either logically or linearly or through time and those kinds of things. So there are actually several types of dementia. There's Lewy bodies dementia. There's dementia caused from brain bleeds and, you know, just deterioration of the brain. But dementia is the most Alzheimer's is the most prevalent of those dementias. About 70 to 75% of all dementia is actually Alzheimer's. And it specifically is a disease that attacks the brain. That there are two major pieces to it. There's what we call tau tangles. So your nerves and ganglion, you know, that go and connect. We all learn that in science, basic science, where they connect and they can pass messages back and forth. Those become elongated, tangled, until you have kind of knots in these nerve endings and things. So it's really hard to communicate. The other piece is what we call plaques, and it's just what it sounds like. plaque starts to build up in the brain. And of course, what that does when you have tau tangles or the plaques, either one, it starts to kill the brain cells around it, just like any kind of tumor or invasion of the brain cells would kill out, you know, brain cells. And the same thing happens. So what starts to happen is the brain just begins to die piece by piece. That can look a little bit different in each individual, even with Alzheimer's, because it might just depend on where that's happening the first and where that's happening the fastest. So dementia actually has many facets to it. One of those is Alzheimer's.
You said there are two different main kinds of Alzheimer's, and is there one that's more common than the other?
Actually, there's one. Alzheimer's is considered either one or both of those with tau tangles and plaques. I would say the major difference that people kind of need to know about right now is as we begin to see medications move onto the market that actually address Alzheimer's, not the symptoms of Alzheimer's, but actual Alzheimer's, and they are there. They're being tested, they're being researched, and they're moving onto the market. And as they are, some of those will address tau tangles. Most of them right now address plaques. And then there's a couple in the pipeline that are going to address both. So it is important for a couple of reasons to work with, you know, your doctor and a neurologist or somebody can help you with assessment so you understand, you know, do I have Alzheimer's? And if so, you know, a little bit about that if you are going to try and go into something that would help treat that.
Now, is there anything that you can do to stem off prior to medication, or is it just biology? I think I read somewhere that if you live long enough, you're going to get Alzheimer's. Is that a fact, or is that a misconception?
That's actually a myth, actually. Okay. A lot of people do believe that Alzheimer's, or dementia in general, is a normal part of aging, but it is in fact not. It is not a healthy part of the brain, and it is something that is attacking the brain. Like I said, whether that's through a brain bleed, whether that's through tau tangles or plaques, whether that's through having Lewy body disease where it kills off part of those blood cells, those are all things that are not normal to aging if you live that healthy life that we talk about. It's not a normal part. Now, I will say your risk increases through age. Your highest risk factor by far is how old you get. So yes, by looking at it from that perspective, you are in a higher risk as you get older, particularly, you know, if you've eaten a lot of fatty foods or you smoke or you don't exercise, but it is not inevitable.
So there are common things that you look that just like heart disease or lung disease that will increase your chances of getting Alzheimer's later on in life.
Right. Yeah. There are people always ask me, is it genetic, is it hereditary? And the answer to both of those is yes. There is a small, very small percentage of it that is actually genetic. And if you have this particular genetic mutation, there is 100% chance that you will get Alzheimer's. And then there's another genetic mutation that is what we call a high risk factor. And, you know, you usually see that like families with multiple dementia family members in there. You kind of identify it that way. You don't necessarily have to have genetic testing done, but that's becoming so common. It is an easier way for people to become, or a way to become diagnosed. I wouldn't say easier necessarily, but that is something that they're starting to lean more on so we can get accurate diagnosis on people and early diagnosis on people. So
what are some of the things that a person can do to kind of stem off those chances?
Yeah. So when we talk about having a healthy brain, or, you know, I call it brain disease and in general prevention, it looks a lot like having a healthy heart and also like eating like a diabetic. So all the same things, which I find this comforting. Not everybody does. I find this comforting. So you want to eat, you know, low fat diet. You know, you want to make sure your cholesterol is under control. You want to make sure your blood pressure is under control, because heart disease and blood pressure will contribute to not having good blood flow through your brain. So that's important to do. Exercise is critical. And of course, not smoking. Smoking just attacks so many parts of our bodies. And the more we start to understand how that affects things, we see that it is a big risk factor for your brain as well. So we do encourage that. Remaining socially active as well as physically active. So, you know, interact socially. Those people, and if you're a big proponent of mental health and substance abuse services, you know, being isolated is a terrible thing for your brain. you know, having a large network of support is critical for people. So as our parents and aunts and uncles age, you know, keeping them engaged with things that they care about and love, that will exercise their brain, as well as making sure they have good social interactions, are really critical for your brain health as well.
What about time period of when you should start worrying about these things or really focusing on these things?
Yeah.
You know, like I'm supposed to get a colonoscopy when I'm 45 or something like right. that. So is that when I should start worrying about being healthy for my brain, if that's something in my history, or is it just from the beginning and then?
Yeah. So, you know, I'll answer that two ways. You know, obviously the longer you live healthy, the higher chances are that you will continue to have a very healthy and robust life, you know, as you age, obviously. But it is also true, both for your heart, your lungs, and your brain, that starting to be healthier anytime in your life, we are amazed at what we start to see about how our bodies can bounce back. Even brain cells that we used to think couldn't regenerate or couldn't recover from things, that is not true. We see that. So I would say eat a heart-healthy diet, you know? Eat a diabetic-friendly diet, so which is like the Mediterranean diet. And some people are like, I do keto. Well, keto is fine. Keto is just a really hard diet for most people to stay on. But a Mediterranean diet is awesome. Even before I joined this organization, I really, really severely restrict my gluten for lots of reasons. And mine was an inflammation issue, only to find out that inflammation is a major factor, again, in brain disease. So, you know, I started that a few years earlier. We all wish we, you know, knew what we know now. But yeah, start anytime. It's always a great thing to do.
Now, we mentioned that a lot of people have dementia touch their families. Do you have specific statistics regarding that in Oklahoma and nationally?
We absolutely do. So nationwide, we have about 6.5 million people who are currently diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And in the state of Oklahoma, we actually have 67,000 people. And that was a survey done in 2020. We don't do a count necessarily every year. The estimated change by 2025 is we'll have 76,000 people with Alzheimer's, which is a 13% increase. And the rate of increase worldwide is becoming more rapid. And we're not exactly sure why that is. That's some of the focus of some of the research. But it is happening. So I think it's really worthy of everybody understanding about brain health and talking to your physician about that. There was an interesting, I work with Department of Health and they do some brain health. And, you know, so as you can imagine, we all completely geek out on data. But one of the things that we found was that, again, brain inflammation is just terrible for your health. And we discovered that people who have had COVID or have inflammatory diseases have an increased risk. The other thing we noticed is, again, the statistics are going up way higher than we estimated 10 years ago that they would be. So the rate is increasing at a faster rate than we expected. And we're trying to figure out what has created that gap. Why do we have this increase higher than we would have expected? So if you looked at a curve, of course, it would look like, you know, a very slant slope. And all of a sudden, we're just like, you know, a slide, we're headed up. So, you know, that bears looking into. So that's some of what we're doing there.
Well, speaking of COVID, I mean, obviously, it's still relatively early in research that they're doing for long-term effects of COVID. Is that a concern that people that have had COVID, even when they're younger, that could affect them later on in life with regards to Alzheimer's specifically?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, we've seen increases in the rates of Alzheimer's. And again, when it all sort of started sorting itself out, because, you know, originally we thought it was a lung, you know, kind of a respiratory type mm-hmm. disease. And really it was an inflammation disease. And once that was realized and treated differently in our hospitals, you know, our death rates went way down because we started treating inflammation. Well, they had brain inflammation too. And particularly people who have had long-term COVID effects are certainly at higher risk for brain damage. And, you know, we believe Alzheimer's as well. So there's lots of concern around that. And I know everyone's interested in kind of continuing the research around that.
I'm sure we'll hear more about that in the coming years.
Absolutely.
Did, you know, it's not a big surprise to most people that Oklahoma is ranked kind of at the lower end of health for healthy population. Does that follow with regards to the incidence of Alzheimer's as well?
It is absolutely true. And I used to say this even when I worked at mental health, and that is, you know, if you have people who have poor heart health and poor diabetic health, you're going to have people with poor brain health. Like you said, they go hand in hand. How you treat your body matters to every organ in your body. So yes, we rank pretty poorly.
Okay. How do we fix that?
Well, again, look at all of those things that we've been told. And I would like to say that this is new to me, but it's not. You know, I knew way in my early 20s, you know, exercise, right? Low-fat diet, low-cholesterol diet, which is, you know, what I strive for. And again, be active socially, mentally, and physically, those things. But whatever you do to keep your heart healthy and keep your diabetes either under control or hopefully before you have a problem with diabetes are things that will be pay off in spades for your brain as well.
Well, good. Well, talk a little bit about the Alzheimer's Association Oklahoma and what you guys do. You've got some education classes, things of that nature that you guys help with this outreach. Obviously, you do podcasts.
Yes, obviously. Well, and I will just say, so this is the part that's obviously near and dear to my heart, so I could go on forever. You may have to wave me off. But so I'm the director of programs for the Alzheimer's Association Oklahoma chapter. So we do cover the whole state of Oklahoma, as I mentioned before. And programs, I always say, is what we do. So do we fundraise? Yes. We also do advocacy. We look for volunteers. We work with places. But programs is what we do as the return of the investment for our communities. So for all of you out there that join our walks and raise money for the longest day and have all of your fundraisers and, you know, really support our organization, the programs is what's given back to the community. So we provide free services in communities who invite us in. Those are education classes. So we have several of those. That's what's going to happen in Brookdale on the 18th is an education class that we've invited the public to. It's all free. We also do information and referrals. So we try and work with the healthcare community, whether that's doctors or PAs or clinics or anyone, so that they can refer to us when they know someone has been diagnosed with a dementia of any kind. So they can really connect them to us via our family support specialists. So we have people who specifically work with families, those people who are recently diagnosed with the disease, as well as their care providers, right? So that's a big piece of what we do. We provide planning and consultation for folks, which is, again, why we encourage early detection, if at all possible. That way the person with that disease can hopefully participate in how do I want this to look and how do I want my estate to be and how can we plan financially and legally for what's going to happen for me, as well as just the details of, you know, informing your family members and deciding how you want that path to look as much as you can possibly control. But planning and care consultation are something that we do, and we actually have a couple of different ways that we can do that. We do it in person. We have a couple of family support specialists, one in Tulsa, one in Oklahoma City, but we also have an 800 number. And I will say, I think of all the things that the Alzheimer's Association provides, this one thing has to be the very best thing that we do. And it's an 800 number that we have that's 24/7. And that 24/7 number can provide crisis counseling if necessary, care consultation, it can give information and referral, it can do planning for people, all via this 800 number, as well as if you say, I'm in Oklahoma, I heard on a podcast that there was going to be an education class, but I didn't get it written down, how do I find this? They will actually go out there and help connect you with that, or you can go to alz.org. And you will see that there are trainings. You enter that in, you enter Oklahoma, and all the trainings we do in Oklahoma pop up. So those are, you know, great things to give to people as tools that we do. And I would say last but certainly not least, we would say is probably, everyone describes this as their life-saving service, which are local support groups for care providers. And we also do some early stage engagement groups as well for persons living with the disease, but those tend to be a lot fewer. We have dozens and dozens of support groups over the state of Oklahoma. And again, caregiving is an incredibly time-consuming and stressful thing to do. We find that about 30% of care providers for people with Alzheimer's wind up dying before the person they're caring for. And there's a lot of reasons around that. Stress is definitely one of the things that contributes to that. But the other thing is they're so busy taking care of their loved one, they ignore their own problems. And a goodly part of those caregivers have chronic illness of their own, particularly if you think of spouses, taking care of spouses. If you have an 80-year-old wife or a 70-year-old husband who has Alzheimer's, chances are you're around that same age and you have other issues too. And they tend not to take care of themselves. So support group really helps with a couple of things. That stress, being socially engaged, giving caregivers an outlet to be around and talk with other people on that same journey, and some of them a little bit ahead of them even, so that they can start to see that path. They have questions, concerns, they have guilt, you know, all kinds of emotions that go along with this, and that support group can wrap around them and lift them up and provide good, solid information as well as support so that they can continue to be a good caregiver and a healthy caregiver as well.
Are these support groups, are they in person?
They're both. So yes, we are back to doing in-person support groups, but we also have some that have chosen to remain virtual. There's one that during COVID, it's on a Sunday, and that's very, very unusual. Actually, we've been told it's the only one in the U.S. So when someone calls the 800 number and says, do you have one on Sunday? We were the only one. So that particular virtual setting has people, a lot of people from Oklahoma, as you might imagine, but people from, there was Michigan, there's Texas, there's Arkansas, you know, people join that support group because it's convenient. And they, when COVID was lessening and we were moving back out into the community, the first thing they said was, please don't stop having this by Zoom. We want to have, you know, our group, you know, they tend to bond. And, so we did. We've just kept that one on Zoom, and they're going to see, we're going to even attempt to maybe make that one both dual, face-to-face for people who are local, but always having the Zoom portion. If it doesn't work, then they're going to be okay with it.
Well, good. Well, yeah, that's one thing technology in the last couple of years has really opened up opportunities to be able to join groups that maybe there aren't enough in your, you know, there might not be enough people in Watonga to have an in-person group, but they can do one online.
Absolutely. And like I said, we have them in Tulsa and Oklahoma City and some of even a broader range like Stillwater. And one of my major reasons for working so hard in Enid, besides the fact that it's very close to my heart, is I want to get support groups started here. I think
so there's not one currently.
There is not one currently in Enid. So we're starting with education services because that's a little easier. And then obviously, as Shelby and I work in this community, we will talk to people about becoming volunteers because we are volunteer powered. So our mission right now is to increase our reach. We're reaching a very small percentage of those caregivers right now, 5-8% of those. We need to increase that reach, and to do that, we need volunteers. We have a wonderful volunteer program. You go through training, so you get online, you go through your training, you get to watch the education classes that you are interested in providing, and then you do a practice class, like you go observe somebody do that, and then someone comes and observes you. You're actually assigned a Alzheimer's staff person who is your mentor and your check-in guide. You can talk to them, you can ask questions, they provide you with materials, and we just have local volunteers in those communities who can provide those at any time. Same way with support groups. We train and support and mentor facilitators for support groups.
Now, you mentioned Shelby a couple of times. You're talking about Shelby Waters, and she's local to Enid, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and so what's her job? What does she do here?
So Shelby Waters is in what we call development. She is the Enid Walk Manager. She lives right here in the Enid community, and so as you might imagine, I volunteered for the Enid Walk last year, came here. That was right before Shelby was hired, so she will be actually is up and running, fundraising for the walk right now, trying to get teams signed on, people joining, and really spreading the word on that. So she is dedicated to walk, but we work together as a team. Fundraising and programs, again, go hand in hand. When Shelby's out there talking in the community and raising money, we talk about research and we talk about providing free services for people. Well, I want free services here in Enid when she's out there fundraising, right? So right now I don't have volunteers, so I'm coming out and doing it myself. Now, I love being here and it's, you know, 40 miles from my dad, so, you know, how great for me to have an excuse to go. But really, ultimately, we need people in these smaller areas who will volunteer and take over those services.
When is that? Now, that's the first interaction that I've had with the Alzheimer's Association is the walk, just being aware of it and seeing them downtown and that sort of thing. When is that each year? When is that scheduled for?
I know she has an exact date. It's in September.
Okay, September. Well, yeah. That was yeah. The main thing.
We're really trying to get it when it's cooler.
Well, a lot of our walks that we do are on First Friday. Do you know if that's going to be?
I know we were trying to get that lined up with First Friday this year, mm-hmm. because last year we couldn't line it up with First Friday. So hopefully that's what we got.
Okay, well, great. Well, if somebody's interested in being part of that Alzheimer's walk then in September, who would they would call Shelby?
Shelby Waters.
And how do you get a hold of her?
You can call, so go ahead and call the 800 number, okay. 800-272-3900.
And I'll put that on the, whenever we publicize this podcast, I'll make sure that and the website address is on there. So
right. And then ask for, you know, the walk manager. The other thing I will tell you, the best way to get to walk, in my opinion, is ALZ.org, because it's all over there. If you go to ALZ.org, you can look up the Oklahoma Walk, and it'll show all the ones that we have. If you click on Enid, you have a direct line to Shelby, her email, her telephone number, any way that there is to get a hold of her. And she would, again, she's like me, like loves being out in the community, wants to talk to people who are interested in donating or starting a team, or, hey, I want to come have my business have a sponsorship or a tent. So all those things are something that we would love to have the community participate in.
So you mentioned a team. What does that consist of? What does a team do?
Well, so a team just fundraises and walks as a team. And the fun thing is, when you have teams, there tends to be a little more friendly competition. So, and I would say one of my favorite team competitions wasn't Enid last year. There were two teams that clearly had been doing this for a long while, and they clearly had a competition to get the most. And oh my word, they had over a dozen people on each team, which is really amazing for some place the size of Enid. But of course, ultimately, it's about who raises the most money. So they had that competition, and it was fantastic. Now, you can go as an individual. There's no doubt about that. You can say, hey, I'd rather be on the committee and plan things. You can do that as well. But generally, people who join, a lot of them do like to have a team together because maybe you want to represent your workplace or your school or your business. A church. We have lots of church groups, faith-based groups, that join as a team. And that's just a way to have people with you who also believe that this is an important issue and, you know, fundraising together.
How long do the walking part is more just for visibility, right?
Right.
So how long does the walking part last? Is it, it's not overnight, right?
No, it was, no. Way back when in the day. It is actually around the town square here in Enid, and which again, I totally love. That's my memories of Enid. So I thought it was awesome. So yeah, really short.
So just for a couple hours.
Yeah, couple of hours.
Well, that sounds really exciting. And so you mentioned that if you wanted to just volunteer to help out with the walk, that you can do that as well by calling Shelby.
Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Any other way? So you got to joining or forming a team, doing some fundraising, joining the group that plans
the committee.
It, uh-huh. The committee. Anything else that somebody could do if they had a heart for Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's research?
Yeah. So some of the other things, I mean, I always talk about resources and opportunities. What can you do? So volunteering is a big piece of that. Some people love to teach and educate and love doing the training piece. You know, we have ready-made PowerPoints, we have speaking points, we do all of that kind of stuff. There are other people who really just like to do things like, I'd rather be a support group facilitator. So particularly people with lived experience really appreciate that. So they will be facilitators so that they can help people get together and really help them walk that path and go through that journey. The other thing we have is we just call them community representatives. If you're not, like, I don't know if I'm going to stand in front of a room full of people and train. I sure don't want to be a facilitator. But, you know, we have health and wellness fairs everywhere, and you're just happy to go pass out pamphlets and visit businesses and, you know, give them pamphlets so that they can hand out information and tell people about the 800 number. We would love to have folks as community reps too. I always said they are just absolutely the, you know, extroverts of the bunch. They tend to know no strangers and love being in a crowd. So community rep is just a great thing to do as well. And then there are a couple things like advocacy as well. So if you have a heart for changing policy, so going to the state capitol and talking about policies that support healthcare for or services for caregivers and people with dementias, then we have people who do that. We also have people who actually go to Washington, D.C. Because as you can imagine, and I always tell people this, they're like, why do you go to Washington, D.C.? Well, policy is part of it. And you don't make big lasting change without policy. Any of us who've been in the world of prevention or in the world of healthcare, whether that's mental health, substance abuse services, changes in policy make things, give people or and give those changes life. They create sustainability. So that's a piece of what you do there. But also, research is so incredibly expensive. We could fundraise 24/7 and not fundraise enough for brain research around the world, right? So part of that is funded through grants provided by private foundations as well as the United States government. They have NIH has a whole brain health, you know, portion of their organization. So they fund a lot of that brain health stuff. So you can get involved as an advocate. But I will also say partnerships are a big piece of what we do. And I talk about building partnerships all the time. I do it with communities. We do it with people who want to educate. We do it with providing information support to people with a disease. So let's say you have a church group. And you're seeing that group is starting to age, and you know that, you know, you've already, we actually got invited by a very, very, very small church in a small town just outside of Oklahoma City a couple months ago. The pastor said they had 3 different people diagnosed in the past month or two with Alzheimer's. So that was a scary position for them to be in and not know anything. And as the pastor, he felt like it was his duty to know something about this. And he invited his team in, as well as his church members, to come in and learn a little bit more about that disease. And he has offered up his place as a support group so that they can have a place to meet and talk. So partnerships can look a lot like offering space to us. We have a partnership with Oklahoma City Metropolitan Libraries. So they allow us to come in once a quarter and provide educational classes at their libraries and provide us free advertising, right? So they like put it on their websites and they send it out in their newsletters and all those kinds of things, which is great because that means we just extend our reach each and every time. So I really do like to ask people to think about how they might partner. Businesses can partner by donating. Businesses can partner by, I tell people all the time, well, you know, what about your employees? I mean, we have people who are aging, so you want them to know what they need to know about Alzheimer's in case that happens to them. But I would be hard-pressed to say if you have more than 25, 30 people in your organization, somebody there is caring for somebody or supporting someone who's caring for somebody with dementia. Mm-hmm. So having those little lunch and learns or inviting us in with pamphlets or whatever is just something that we can do.
Well, you talked some about, or the main things we've talked about today are the Alzheimer's Association does is provide support and education. Did you mention that, or do you guys provide research dollars to research organizations that are doing Alzheimer's research?
Yes, we do. Now, that actually comes from home office. We have a whole enormous research division, and they're full of so many of the leading experts in the field there. And what they do is they work with organizations around the globe, but also here locally in Oklahoma. There are a couple we're working on right now where we can do some research. As a matter of fact, one of the critical genes in identifying Alzheimer's was actually discovered in Oklahoma. So now I think we haven't done a whole lot since then, but I know they're trying to get back in the game. And there's just so much to do, like you said, with you look at a complication like COVID. And I just think stepping up the research is just going to help, hopefully, help bring some of these drugs that they're not cures yet. I don't want anyone to think that we're on the verge of stopping Alzheimer's. They won't prevent it and they don't cure it. What they do is, but they actually address the Alzheimer's itself, the plaques and the tau tangles, so that we can arrest and or slow the disease. So yeah, all of the research around that is funded out of the Chicago office. And I'll tell you, there is, so again, under ALZ.org, there's a whole research portion. Someone asked me the other day, well, you know, can we like take a look at some of this research? And I said, actually, you can take a look at all of the research. It's literally listed out there. And the research papers are linked in. I know I'm a complete geek. I have been out there and read some of them. So if you have interest in that, you can actually go to that website and read some of those research papers.
Going on. Now, just backing up just a moment, you talked about support groups. I think that sounds really great. And so, and just dealing with some clients in the past that have been dealing with dementia, family members. Are you guys ready for a support group here in Enid? If somebody was willing to start it, or is it something that y'all are kind of moving towards eventually?
No, I will tell. So right now, the biggest barrier I will tell you is finding someone who's willing to take that support group on as the facilitator. But we are completely prepared to receive that person. So anybody who says, I would love to start a support group, I'll be the facilitator, or me and, you know, Carrie Jo, my best friend, are going to be co-facilitators on this. We already can get them in. We'll get them started on their volunteer papers and process. We can get them trained and we can start to mentor them so that they can begin that thing, that support group as quickly as they can be trained. And that does, I mean, depending on how busy people are, because most of our people do other things, you know, they work and they care for people a lot of times. But as soon as they can get through that support training and we can give them the experience that they need, we can put them out in a support group. There are all kinds of people in Enid who've already kind of indicated that they would let us have space, you know, where we could have one of those.
We're very generous that way.
Absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. So yeah, I think Enid is ready. I think there are lots of people and places I've talked to, even from the walk last year, they're like, yes, we need that so desperately. Mm-hmm. So we're just looking for people who are willing to be facilitators.
What's kind of the time commitment? Or do most groups meet once a month, once a week? What?
So most groups meet twice a month. Okay. Some meet once a month. But what they generally find when they do that is that's not enough. And there's two reasons. One, that's a long time to wait if you're, you know, needing support. But the other part is too, caregivers can't always make a meeting. Mm-hmm. If maybe the person who's going to help take care of their loved one while they're gone for an hour, like misses out, then it's another whole month before they can get around there. So twice a month is pretty normal for most of what we do.
Well, that's something that I found, especially I'm a member of a support group, that during COVID, that we've lost a lot of that connection, and we're becoming more and more isolated. And I don't think a lot of people realize how impactful and helpful a support group can be, even just talking for a few minutes about like what you're going through, or knowing. For me, what was a big deal was knowing other people were going through the same thing, and that made all the difference in the world. Yeah. And just made me feel better about myself. When I hear that we don't have one right now and that's all we need is somebody to facilitate that, it doesn't sound like it'd be a big time commitment, the training. You guys offer it.
Online. Like I said, we're supportive. I have a volunteer manager who helps you get through your paperwork if you have any questions and get you through all sort of what I call that sort of technical piece, you know, that people, it's not hard, but it can be just so complicated, it sounds like sometimes. So we just help people through that. And then, like I said, you go through the training courses, you will observe some support groups. And then again, you'll be mentored, be assigned a mentor so that you can kind of learn that process. And we would just love to get them going here.
So if somebody was interested in doing that, would they call Shelby here in town?
Nope, they can call me.
Okay. And how'd they get a hold of you?
They can get a hold of me. Well, now see, I thought I had my card sitting right here. So my number is 405-279-6195.
Okay. And I'm certain that if if they didn't hear that particular part, that if they did talk to Shelby, that she'd be able to get them in contact with you, right?
She absolutely can get them in contact with me. And now I'm going to check my number because I give out way too many telephone numbers. And I will just say I am notorious for displacing 9165.
9165.
Yes, okay. 9165. So 405-279-9165.
All right, great. We got the walk coming up in September. That's really exciting. So I'm glad we talked about that. It gives us plenty of time for people to form teams and volunteer on that if they'd like. But coming up on, July 21st, you're going to be giving a talk, Understanding Alzheimer's and Dementia, and that's sponsored by Brookdale Senior Living. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is, again, just one of those relationships that came about because, you know, Shelby's in town and we have a walk and that kind of thing. And they just called me and said, hey, you know, we would love if you would come and talk to our staff, you know, do a little education for them. And we do that. It's not the focus of what we do, but we do that. And I said, I would love to do that. So here's what I would look for out of a partnership with you. I said, I would appreciate it if you would invite the public. And so we talked about that for a while, and they really got fired up about it. Ron was just so great about it. She and I have really developed quite a nice relationship. And so we're having a lunch and learn for the staff because it has to really be quick. But she has just done yeoman's work to get an evening public event for everybody, a nice long hour where I can do a presentation, people can ask questions, they can connect with one another if they want to. They're going to provide light refreshments, which is why they're asking for people to RSVP. And so I'm really looking forward to it. So I think that's a great way for people to kind of dip their toe in, particularly if they know somebody or are concerned about somebody, to learn a little bit more about that. But, you know, yeah, sometimes we present to people all the time that I have no connection to that disease yet. Okay, well, lucky you. Let's go ahead and make sure you have a little bit of knowledge under your belt. So by all means, come out and join us.
Well, that sounds really exciting. And definitely, I think that was a start that Brookdale is going to do a monthly lecture series, I believe. And this is the first one in that lecture series. They said that they're providing sandwiches and drinks. So that's really cool. It's 5:30 to 6:30 on July 21st. But they would like an RSVP by July 18th. And that number is 405-229-4334. Again, that's 405-229-4334. You can call Brookdale and they will get you signed up for that, and that way they have enough food. Now, if you show up on the 21st, I'm sure they're not going to turn you away. You just might not get to eat. That's happened to me a couple of times. I've hit a group and they've had snacks, but they didn't have enough, so I didn't get to eat if I didn't RSVP. But that sounds really, really cool. And if somebody I'm going to repeat it again. If somebody's interested in starting a support group or being part of a support group, that may be a good thing to come to as well.
That'd be a great thing to come to. Give you an opportunity to meet myself and may have one of my team members here as well, so that we can, again, get to know the community a little more.
Well, if there's one thing that you want people to take away from this conversation that we've had, what would that be?
You know, I think if there's one thing people would take away, please know that there is help out there. Nothing tears at our hearts more than to hear someone say, I wish I had known when, because we've failed somebody if that happens. We want to know that anybody who is going through this disease, themselves, with a family member, a neighbor, a church member, that knowing about it and being as comfortable as you can about it is what, again, takes away that stigma. One of the worst things that happens is people become very, very isolated, which is terrible. So it is our mission for people to know as much about this as possible and that we don't miss somebody who needs us out there right now. So there are services. They are free out there, 800-272-3900. And you can find out where those education classes are in Oklahoma. You can look for support groups close to you. And you can go out on ALZ.org and find all kinds of walks and research and how to become a volunteer and all of those things as well.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Michelle, for joining Enid Monthly in Depth. We really appreciate it. Check out the comments for the resources that she's mentioned today, and be sure to sign up by RSVP by July 18th if you want to come and Understanding Alzheimer's and Dementia at Brookdale Senior Living this month.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.